I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. We are doing our Sunday live stream on Saturday, and we're going to continue doing that from now on. We just decided to switch. Nick Gilvey and I decided to switch. It's because of my advanced old age. Basically, I decided that doing a stream that goes from 1 o'clock Pacific Standard Time to 3 o'clock just cuts into my nap time too much. So anyway, I decided that we were going to switch times so I can stream for 2 hours and then get a good nap in. In any case, Nick was very gracious and agreed to do that. So this is how we're going to do it from now on. The Countercurrents Radio Brain Trust will be on Saturdays, and Nick Gilvey and the Writer's Block will be on Sundays. So I want to welcome two guests. We have two brains for the Brain Trust besides me. The first is, of course, a longtime writer and many time guest, Jim Goad. Jim, welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you.
And we also have a new brain for the Brain Trust, Thomas Steuben, who's done a lot of writing for Countercurrents. Thomas, welcome.
Hey, great to be here.
So we are going to just talk about the news and answer your questions. And if you have questions, folks, the best way to ask those questions is to help us out. Help us out with a donation. And the only way you can do that easily right now is to go to entropystream.live/countercurrents. If you go to entropystream.live/countercurrents and hit the green button to leave a paid chat, you will be able to use a credit card, which is something that we are forbidden by the entire global credit card processing industry from taking. But there is one platform out there, a brave little platform called Entropy, and they believe in freedom of speech. And so you can actually use your card to send us a donation along with your question and comment, and we will definitely get to them in the course of today's stream. There's a lot that's happening in the world today, and I would like to hear some of your thoughts. So let's begin with some of the stuff that's going on. Thomas has written recently about the situation with the Afghanistan withdrawal. He's covered some topics related to foreign policy. And the latest foreign policy related thing has to do with submarines. So can you fill us in a bit on that? I think this is a kind of an amazing unfolding story. And it really shows that the United States doesn't seem to be completely in control of the globe like they thought they were just a little while ago.
I absolutely can. So after Afghanistan had its debacle, China immediately began saber-rattling against Taiwan very loudly, even told them, hey, you might want to buy some Chinese flags when we come in so we know that you're a loyalist. And so Zog, I don't want to say us anymore, I'm trying to not use that phrase, but Zog or the U.S. government realized that Taiwan's days are probably numbered, but they don't want Taiwan to fall. That's just too much to take all at once. So they did this emergency deal with Australia to give them nuclear submarines, nuclear-powered submarines. And this has ruffled feathers because, first of all, France had a contract for that, and we basically stole the contract. So France, Macron, who is totally a globalist shill just like everyone else, was not happy. So it seems like there's already, just like we on the right have a lot of infighting, the globalists are now infighting amongst themselves because at the end of the day, yes, there's ideology, yes, there's part of this evil globalist empire, but it is about power. They're all trying to, in a very Machiavellian, Thucydidean way, get their deal. And so, no, they're not actually making, you know, as we sometimes think, making these deals in smoky back rooms where there's, you know, these strange schizophrenic theories. They're petty, incredibly petty. So France is very angry about this. And also, China isn't happy either. China has basically declared that if this goes through, this makes Australia a valid target for a nuclear strike if there was to be a nuclear war. I don't know if a nuclear war is actually possible now because it requires one party to launch first. I'll be honest, I don't think the U.S.-NATO alliance has the guts to shoot nuclear weapons. They're too weak. I think it's a paper tiger. because at the end of the day, China can eat up one, probably take 1 to 3 nukes to the face, keep moving forward. Just like they say in Rocky, it's not how hard you hit, it's how hard you can get hit, keep moving forward. China taking a nuke to the face would galvanize the people. In contrast, I don't think we could lose a single aircraft carrier to hypersonic missiles and not have huge issues with morale, will to fight, because that is what war is about. It's not about blowing stuff up, it's about the will to fight and breaking it.
Right.
And two, the fact that this is in Australia, Australia is having massive civil unrest right now. So this whole nuclear submarine deal is predicated upon the premise that the Australian government will not be one way or another removed or modified by its own people. Which to me begs a question of, if that does happen, will America send in, quote, or the UN peacekeepers to Australia to kind of, you know, get the Aussies in line? They're already fighting their own government. This will be full global homo tyranny for the whole world to see. So that's a different question. Really, I think this really shows that the globalist hegemony is in a reactive mode. They're no longer in active mode. All these things, like these possibilities, China and France freaking out, should have been foreseen. They seem to have not been foreseen, so that's good. The globalist agenda is no longer calling the shots. They're in damage control mode.
You know, one thing that struck me about the debacle in Afghanistan was the fact that they didn't seem to have any contingency plans in place for preventing, what, $83 billion worth of weapons from falling into the hands of the Taliban. Now, a normally functioning military has people sitting in offices coming up with contingency plans for the most ridiculous things. Like, how would we invade Norway through Finland, right? Or how would Hungary launch a strike against Poland or something like that? They do the most ridiculous contingency planning, the most unlikely scenarios. They're constantly coming up with ways to handle that. That's just some people's jobs. It didn't occur to them to secure these weapons or destroy these weapons in case their government, their puppet government, folded up like a cheap suit, which it did. And that strikes me as a sign that they're failing. They're failing at a very deep level. They're not rational anymore. They're not doing their jobs. They're not considering the possibility that people won't like their decisions and people will resist them. People will say no. And I think that is a sign of a regime that's in its late stages. And it might actually be later than a lot of us think for the U.S. government, if they're this stupid in executing this withdrawal from Afghanistan. And now you're saying that they've... And the other thing that's extraordinary to me is they have immediately pivoted from a debacle in Afghanistan to something even worse, which is truculence towards nuclear powers. I don't understand that. Do you have any insight into what they're doing here? Because it would seem to me, if they were rational, that they would, they would take a step back, take a breather, reassess things, rather than go lurching into another potentially even greater disaster.
Well, first thing, I think there's a huge difference between making a plan and having the guts to follow through with it during a crisis. And these people have never dealt with a real crisis. We have for probably many decades only dealt with war where we're the ones, we do it on our time, in our manner, in our choosing. We never, I know it's kind of lowbrow, but use video game terms, they've never played real player versus player. It's always, let's go beat up Serbia or Iraq. And so they've never dealt with someone who's a real problem. Now, you did have a little precursor to this with ISIS. The real ISIS, not this ISIS Khorasan fake thing that isn't probably even real. ISIS took over large swaths of Iraq within days because the Iraqi military was revealed as being basically a town guard mall cop force. And they didn't know what to do. They did do some short notice deployments, but with Afghanistan, I think they had plans. But I'm not sure if they had the guts to fall through with it. Like, okay, what do we do? Will we anger the Pakistanis? Are we willing to shed more blood here? Because here's the thing I've noticed is that Zog doesn't like, they can deal with a slow trickle of blood, but they don't want to have newsworthy events like the very unfortunate suicide blast at the airport, this botched drone strike where they killed all civilians. So I think they were thinking, okay, do we send the special forces? What happens after that? And really, like, war is being dictated by politics now. It's all about the effect on the home front. So I think it's part of that. It's like they can have these complicated plans about Hungary and Denmark, but they'll never put them into action. This isn't, at the end of the day, it's not a video game. They have to make a dangerous decision, follow through, which is a very masculine, objective thing. And they're all kind of these hysterical types. Like we've seen Psaki, Biden's cabinet. These are not great military leaders or even politicians. They're more like managers, and they manage. And managers usually don't know how to deal with a crisis.
Well, another thing that's going on here is we've been hollowing out the military and hollowing out all the institutions of our society. How does this happen? Well, it happens when you replace the criteria. Okay, a well-functioning institution chooses people to make it work. And the criteria for hiring and promotion have everything to do with performing the ends of the institution, whatever the institution is, whether it's the military or the fire department or a business or whatever. That's how institutions are excellent, when they have good people who are actually promoting its aims rather than getting in the way of its aims. Now, the whole diversity cult basically is introducing irrelevant competing considerations into every institution in our society. Now it's not good enough for the fire department to be full of strong men who are capable of rushing into burning buildings, carrying heavy equipment and stuff like that. No, they have to be diverse. They've got to have some women, maybe some transsexuals in there, maybe somebody in a wheelchair. They've got to have a cat on, not just a dog, but a cat, you know. And why? Well, because our overlords are in a fit of, egalitarian hysteria. This is their religion. And instead of demanding that they, wear crosses and be Christians or something, they're demanding that they all bow to the diversity god. And it gets in the way of the institution performing its function. Now, you can do that for a long time. You can hollow out institutions, and you can make them filled with people who are not there to actually perform the institution's functions. So what are their motives? Well, everybody has their private motives, their job, right? It's a job. And the difference between a flourishing institution and a failing one is that the people who perform the jobs have some sense of identifying with the success or failure of the whole thing. But if you're a diversity hire, you know that you're not there because they're thinking in terms of whether or not the military is going to be able to kill people effectively, right? You're there basically because it's your dream. Right. Or because you're a token of social justice or progress or whatever. And so they're there for personal interests.
Yeah. Or just, welfare. I hate to say it, but the GI Bill, free healthcare, there is a, we try to act like everyone who joins the military did it for serve their country. That's not true. Even for a lot of white men, even the patriotic ones, there's a lot of like, they even for the recruiter, they don't talk about how you can go do barbed wire, all this cool stuff. It's increasingly like, we give you free healthcare and the GI Bill.
Yeah.
So they've kind of shot themselves in the foot with that. They encourage people to join for the wrong reasons.
Yeah. The difference between a job or a career and a racket, I think, is a good distinction to make. If you belong to an honorable profession, right? The idea of an honorable profession sort of builds in a code so that the people who get in this profession are there to use their skills to do good. This is why medicine is an honorable profession, right? They're not just there to make money. They're there to do good. The military has a certain honor to it because they're there to do something risky and important. But if they're not there to do these things, if they're just there for their own personal interests, then it just becomes a racket. They become cynics. And you can have institutions rotted out with cynicism where everything's a racket, where nobody's concerned about making the institution work, performing its actual functions, putting out fires or fighting wars or whatever. And it can go along for a very, very long time until it actually gets tested. And then you find that your, you know, tranny fire department can't put out fires effectively, or your diversity military can't fight wars effectively.
Or they can't do intel and they kill like 10 civilians, including 6 kids, like with the latest drone strike.
Yeah, exactly. And so they're getting tested now. And of course, it's beautiful that all of this is happening under this incredibly PC administration, where all of these people, Kamala Harris really thinks that she's qualified to be president of the United States. She probably thinks she deserves it. All of these people are completely detached from reality right now. And it's all fine, again, when there's no test. But when they're getting tested, you're going to start seeing things fall apart. And I see that happening. Jim, we should bring you in on this. What have you been thinking about as you've been watching America retreating from Afghanistan and now maybe blundering into a war with China?
I mean, I've said for decades, the only real war situation is the one on the southern border. Everything else is unnecessary and is destroying the country. But when you were talking about this, I'm thinking, is it just ineptitude or is it a longer game to undermine national confidence? I think it might be the latter. I mean, if we are controlled by globalist forces, they don't want national confidence. Maybe, I mean, you know, things are the national stage and the way the news is manufactured. It's purposeful. I think it's part of a longer game to just undermine national. And, you know, diversity is another reason to undermine national confidence. It's not a nation anymore. So I think it's by design more than clumsiness. Maybe they put, you know, clumsy puppets up there to look inept, but I think there's a longer, more strategic game going on there. Well, I was in Australia once. The second time I couldn't get in because they realized I'm a felon. But I remember this guy, he was driving me around downtown Melbourne. That's a huge city. It looks like Chicago, like 3 million people. But he was saying, you know, we're a nation of 20 million people and we've got China, like 1.5 billion looming right over us. It was just terrifying when he said that to me. And China is a nation. The U.S. is not and hasn't been for a long time. And I'm real dismal about the U.S.'s prospects, no matter what kind of fighting spirit our rainbow troops have or anything. I'm very pessimistic about the future of America, and the sooner it folds, the better I am with it.
Well, my feeling is that the best thing that could happen for nationalism in Europe is the American globalist regime, the globalist American empire failing or becoming so weak that they just stop taking America's phone calls. Thomas, do you think that's coming? For instance, with Macron's reaction to this nuclear submarine deal, do you think there's a pattern emerging here?
Yes, because it wasn't just Macron. Recently, Germany had a kind of a tiff with the globalists too, where they created the Nord Stream 2 pipe, which is a big deal because it allows basically Russia to sell gas to Europe, especially Germany. And this has ruffled feathers. So, yes, Merkel is a globalist. She's part of the whole globalist Zog faction. But here she is. She's making a deal with Russia, an arch enemy of the globalist faction, because it's to her benefit. And at some point, I think they're going to say, hey, Zog, you know, the globalists are a paper tiger. They cannot hurt us. They can't protect us. And eventually, they're going to start going their own way, like not really caring, like, I think Japan is going to have to make a decision where right now our deployment in Japan just causes problems with locals because the troops there are it's usually the quote diverse troops causing these problems, but with like, they don't get along there in Okinawa. We've run our all welcome there and we can't even probably protect them from China. So I think Japan might say, yeah, we're going to either come to terms with the Chinese hegemony or arm up ourselves. So it's going to be everyone, I think, saying, no, we don't trust you to either, one, we don't trust you to be like straight with us and be honorable. Two, we don't trust you to not fold because you're weak. So this is just spreading. We're going to see more and more of this.
Yeah, I think so too. And I have some hope that a better world will come out of this. But the trouble is that there are so many unpredictable factors that are going to now come into play if the United States falters. We have troops in what? We've got bases all around the world now. We have all these obligations to defend people. We're sitting on little bushfire wars and preventing them from happening all over the place. And as soon as the Afghan thing happened, it was quite remarkable how the Chinese started saber rattling towards Taiwan. This is the kind of thing that happens when even evil empires start showing signs of weakness. A lot of people are going to start challenging the United States, and a lot of people are going to, there are going to be a lot of little conflicts that suddenly become hot, I think, as U.S. power starts to wane. And a lot of these conflicts can grow. I mean, one day you're declaring war on Serbia, and then the next day the whole world's in flames. That kind of stuff happens. It's happened in the past, and so it's going to create, in the short term, a lot of danger and instability. But honestly, given the trajectory of U.S. power, it's better that the U.S. be unstable even than stable. I don't want this current government, this current system, to be on sound military, financial, economic footing. I want it to be as unstable as possible, because that means that its life will be shortened.
I mean, the U.S. has quantifiably the most powerful military on Earth. I just don't think, I think by design, it's not being used. When was the last decisive victory? The Gulf War, 32 years ago? That was it. Lost everything since. Everything's gotten worse. And I know it's cliche, but plenty of problems here. I'd much rather they be entirely isolationist and try to fix what's wrong here. Probably can't do that without a civil war, though, so... Not sure what to say about that, but I don't know why we're in, you know, Borneo, for example. We have Detroit to deal with.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. We have a few questions here. So one of our longtime commentators, Sutton, has written in. This is a new topic, but I think it's an interesting topic. He wants to know our thoughts on no-fault divorce. And since I have never been married, much less divorced, I'm not going to go first. Jim, do you want to go first on this one?
Oh, God. I mean, no fault. I'm not sure even what the laws are. I know that men get screwed in custody battles. I pay child support. I can't deduct it from my taxes. She doesn't have to declare it as income. She doesn't have to even account for where a dollar of it goes. Like, doesn't have to prove that any of it goes toward my kid. No fault in, like, what, cheating or violence? I'm not even sure what the topic
is. Yeah, well, in the past, there was this idea that you had to show cause for divorce, basically. That there had to be some kind of things like cruelty or violence or
I think if someone wants out, they should be able to get out. Yeah.
Simple as that. So, yeah, you think that no fault divorce is a good thing.
Yeah.
What about you, Thomas? Do you have thoughts on it?
I think it's a disaster, especially if there are kids involved, because we can thank Ronald Reagan for this. In California, he started it and then just spread like wildfire, so great rhino. But basically, like, courts, they said, we don't want police relationships because our dockets are full doing other nonsense. So trying to get into like a Jerry Springer show was too much. So they pushed for this, but at the same time, you know, at some point you have to be like, okay, there's kids involved and there is a state interest in kids being raised in a functional family. And two, it's also a whole problem. The rubber hits the road. It's 90% usually against the man, and the man always gets destroyed. It's always, they have to pay money and it's just ridiculous. And at some point you have to go to court. Like, say if she gets a job, you can be like, situation has changed. She doesn't need alimony. Right. But then this creates a perverse incentive. Why would she get a job if that would mean her getting less money for free?
Well, what we have now is man's fault divorce.
Yeah.
That's the institution.
Yeah.
It's that. But I mean, as far as just someone feeling trapped, I think they should have the right to leave with, you know, but not leave kids unattended for any of that either. Sure. But right now, I mean, it's stacked against guys. I know that as well as I think, or maybe better than most guys do.
Yeah, I think that every society has an interest in making marriages more stable. And I think no-fault divorce actually made marriages less stable. It made it easier to get out of them. Okay, say that you want to get out of your marriage because it's just an unhappy marriage. Unhappy marriages usually have cause for divorce in them. And if they don't have cause, that it can be manufactured, right? You can check into a hotel with a woman you're not married to, and then you've got cause, right? If you're in a really desperately unhappy situation, there are still ways of getting out. But no-fault divorce made it trivial almost, and it made it possible for people to just blow up relationships on a whim. And as soon as no-fault divorce came in, the divorce rate went to, 50%? I mean, there's a very clear causal connection between no-fault divorce making it easy to get out of marriage and the number of marriages that fail. And honestly, I think that if it's a little more difficult for marriages to be blown up on a whim, then it's more likely that people will work out their problems and you'll have stabler families. And that's a good thing for the next generation.
Assuming people can work out their problems. I mean, what if they rush into it and they're incompatible? Should they just toil in misery for decades so society feels better? I disagree.
Yeah. Well, here's another thing though. Once it became easier to get out of marriage, I think it became, less of a people took it less seriously when they got into it. They were less deliberate about it because, well, you know, if it doesn't work out, you can just get out easily. And so I do think that it should be a serious decision that people make. And if it's less easy to get out of, then I think people will be more careful getting into it. And that might mean that you would avoid some of those really bad situations. But yeah, I wrote a piece on divorce called Irreconcilable Differences, The Case for Racial Divorce, where I talk about the difference between, no-fault divorce and divorce with cause or fault. And the argument I made is that although a lot of people who are conservative have a good argument and just sort of deep reservations about making it easy for individuals or couples to divorce, let's put it that way, when you look at the race problem, I think it would be great if we just had a no-fault divorce with Black people, for instance, or other groups, and just say our ways of living are not compatible. If you look at the reasons that are given for dissolving families, breaking up marriages, divorces, there are things like different tastes and different spending habits and different values and so forth. Those are things that can cause marriages to break down and those are considered legitimate. And divorce is considered a legitimate solution to these problems. But for some reason, when you have different races living in seething conflict with one another, because they're very different and they have different styles of life, well, no, we've just got to stay together and work this out. We've got to sacrifice more and show them that we really, really mean well. I just think it's actually a great thing, to just say, look, if we really are incompatible, and we all deserve to be happy, right? Why don't we just go our separate ways?
Well, I think the analogy works both ways. I think the problem with the left is they don't see the racial case, and a lot with the traditionalist right, they don't see the personal case. I spent a lot of my childhood praying every night that my parents would get divorced, and I think if they did, I would have grown up more well-adjusted. When you're in an unhappy family where there's constant shouting and violence, it warps you and damages you. And for the most part, and maybe this, again, I'm an outlier in a lot of these cases. I think it's none of anyone else's business but the two people who are married.
Well, right. I think maybe no-fault divorce could work if it comes with valid prenuptials. Right now, at least in California, to get a prenuptial at such a high bar might as well not work, because you have to get, okay, she has to be counseled by an attorney who's separate. And that attorney, like, basically you can't have any coercion, which means this has to be like months before the marriage. She gets her own attorney, and the attorney will, of course, tell her, don't sign it. And so it's this complicated patty cake thing. And there's no, you know, it's almost impossible to get it done in California. Then you still have the problems of a judge maybe striking it down on a whim because reasons or some pretext.
And I so think you, prenuptials kind of introduce distrust from the get-go, which I don't think is good either. I mean, why would, like, someone you're planning to divorce, then just don't get married, I guess.
Well, I think it's kind of like a contract where it'd be like a white piece almost. Like, we'll go back to status antebellum. No one pays anyone anything unless it's necessary, or just like split the property instead of like this weird alimony thing. Because if you let a woman know, if she wants to walk away, she gets to basically hold you up for alimony. It's like that creates this weird power dynamic where it's like there is kind of this unspoken sword of Damocles there.
Yep. Absolutely. That's why it's man's fault divorce these days.
Yeah. One of the comments here by Komi Kobayashi cracks me up. I'm so tired of women's whims being the number two value in our society. The number one value in our society, I think, is probably placating neurotic Jews. But definitely the number two value in our society is catering to the whims of women. Women initiate, what, 75% of the divorces, I believe. It's an astonishingly high number. They also initiate like 75% of the extramarital affairs too. At least I've seen that statistic thrown around in some context. So I do think it's an interesting question, though. I do think that if people just aren't compatible, that alone is an argument for why they shouldn't have to live together. And since I don't think no-fault divorce is going to go away anytime soon, I'm content to use it as a premise for arguing for racial separation. I think it's actually a great argument for racial separation. If all the reasons that people leave marriages are valid, the same reasons apply absolutely to the races going their separate ways. I wonder if somebody could put a link to my piece. Ah, here it is. It's Gaddis already read my mind. It's in the comments.
I mean, so I think things such as alimony are insane. If she didn't get the education and didn't make the money, it shouldn't be any of hers. Child support's a different thing. But again, I think there should be laws where she has to prove that it goes to the child. And that doesn't exist now. And she should have to declare it as income, and I should get to deduct it.
Absolutely. And if you want to know something really messed up, so in California, whether or not it becomes, we're this weird community property state because it's weird legal thing that we got from the Spaniards who got it from the Visigoths. That's like autistic tangent for another day. Basically, if it's community property, it gets split down the middle. So she gets half. So is any wealth generated community property? The question there is, was it built, one, through effort? So you put in effort, she gets half, which doesn't make sense because it was your effort. She's just kind of like, you know, blah, blah, shopping. But if it was by accident, like you got inheritance or your stocks went up and you weren't like a manager of the company, your stocks just, your Bitcoin just exploded. Well, that's not community property. So it's almost reversed. It's almost like if you did work out, you're going to be penalized for it. So we're creating this, again, perverse incentives, which create perverse results where hard work is penalized. And they kind of go, like you, I know you said this whole prenuptial kind of like takes it from the get-go, but with that 50% divorce rate, I feel like it's already tainted. So it's like we just have to, I think, put our foot down and try to get a good prenuptial. I think it's a good policy goal, maybe, just saying, hey, no fault divorce, but we need a prenuptial so that we aren't dragged through the mud.
Yeah. So let me thank a few people here who have been sending in donations. Folks, if you would like to help out by sending your DLive tokens, that would be great. We can take those as well. We will cash those in. Nationalist.org just donated one diamond. What do you think about the show lost? Well, maybe you meant with a capital L, the show Lost. Maybe that's it. You know, I hated that show, frankly, if that's what you're, if you're talking about. I just thought it was a giant, it was just a giant tease. There were all these things that were introduced to try and get you interested and keep you hooked. And it was just never resolved into anything coherent. It was an incredibly cynical, jerk job, frankly. Folks, we also have a matching grant going on. So anything you donate during the course of this stream will be matched up to about 24, I think more than $2,200. So that is an extra incentive to give. So I want to thank a few people. Crux has written in with $52. Thank you very much. David Blue has written in. I know that's not your real name. Has written in with $20. And thanks, Spencer J. Quinn, for his Pope Francis Enemy of White's piece, which I think is a great piece. Thank you for your donation. Slaughtered Remains has sent in $131. That's very generous. Jasper has written in with $150. That is very good. And Gadius has written in with $30. So let's take Jasper's question, okay? On July 4th, Patriot Front held a march in Philly. This sparked debate about the value of such IRL events. Trav LeBlanc made a strong argument against them, which Greg echoed. But in Greg's 2017 article, Unite the Right Did Nothing Wrong, he made a case for small, disciplined, unannounced events that our side should just document and disseminate. Didn't Patriot Front do just that? Or did you change your opinion on the risk-benefit calculation of IRL activism since then? Are you a lawyer, Jasper? Anyway, no, this is a good question. My big objection to Unite the Right, the first one, was that, well, first of all, you could see the left gathering for months. And it was just obvious that they had friends in high places, and this just looked more and more like a trap. When you announce where you're going to be months in advance, that gives your enemy months in advance to plan ahead. And I just thought that that was strategically a very bad thing, especially given the location, Charlottesville, which is a college town full of absolutely rabid leftists. I thought that the kind of things that the identitarians in Europe do is better, because what they will do is they will have a small events that are basically banner drops, things like that, stunts that, you know, putting a veil on Queen Maria Theresa and filming it. They do the stunt, and they also film it and frame it and get it out there media-wise, and then they disperse, and the enemy shows up, you know, after the fact. You know, they don't have any advance warning, so they can't really counter protest or mess things up. I think that's a lot better strategically. Now, the Patriot Front thing, I don't know if it was announced in advance. If they did a legal march, they had to get some kind of permission and have the police there. In which case, they're doing the same thing that I think Unite the Right did wrong. Now, the Unite the Right, the two event, I thought actually went okay. For reasons I outline in an argument, in an article at Countercurrents. But basically, they were completely protected by the police. And there were like, 20 of them or something, against a mob of like thousands of howling Antifa. And it was actually very instructive as an event. But I don't think that the event that Patriot Front did is comparable to the identitarian type stunts that I thought would be a better strategic alternative to what Unite the Right was. Again, we just don't have the ability to project force in public, in the streets of the regime. We just don't have the ability to do that. And things are so massively stacked against us that we have to do other forms of activism. So, Jim, do you have any thoughts on this issue more broadly?
More broadly, I'm not a rally guy. I've never gone to any kind of activist event in my life. But I also understand power, I think, enough that you need to have control of the streets to have any sway in what happens. So it's quite a quandary because it's basically been outlawed. I mean, I know Gavin, the Proud Boys, when he relinquished control of them, a bunch of knuckleheads and informants took over. That proved disastrous. I think January 6th, and I know I'm in a minority here, was optically much worse than Charlottesville. But you need that presence in the streets, or you're just going to be hiding or, you know, doing live streams or whatever. But I don't know, until things blow over, it's probably good to lay low in public because the police are obviously on one side.
Yeah, absolutely. So what do you think, Thomas?
I think there's a workaround this, actually. So right now, normal people are riled up about the vaccine mandate and the stolen election. So I think, I don't want to say hijack, but we can kind of, you know, can hijack. We can kind of, you know, infiltrate these rallies, mix with normal people. And I think this whole thing of like, we need to be our whole dissident brand special symbol thing maybe needs to go away. And we just focus on normalizing the radical and radicalizing the normie at this point, because they are angry. We have like mama, you know, just soccer moms who are very angry right now. We can redirect that anger. We can get involved with our community. I think if we stand with normal people, that's kind of like, that makes it harder to attack us, because Saul Alinsky always said you want to isolate the target. But now we make them attack all society, which isn't tenable.
And absolutely. I mean, one of the things that they have now done is they have identified everybody who voted for Donald Trump basically as a domestic extremist.
Yeah, if you're not getting the vaccine, you're also a terrorist. So we're all in this, quote, all in this together.
Yeah, and they did that to us. And now a lot of these people, of course, say, oh, no, I'm not one of those horrible people. White people, especially white people, they want to be liked. They want to be respected. They want people to know that they have the best of intentions and good hearts. And they don't want to have enemies. White people don't go around wanting to have enemies. They're not the kind of people generally who go into a room and start thinking about picking fights. That's not social behavior. It's not pro-social behavior. But white people have to start understanding that you may not want to have enemies. You may not choose to have enemies, but enemies can choose to have you. And the enemy has now chosen 80 million people as their opponents, which is just insane. But right, as the old saying goes, those whom the gods would destroy, they first drive mad. And that's what the left is behaving like. They're behaving like madmen.
Well, I'd say 80 million and counting. They're radicalizing normal liberals like Nicki Minaj. I know it's kind of silly, but liberals are realizing the election is stolen and, you know, medical tyranny is stupid. So they're actually increasingly coming open towards us.
Absolutely. We had a question here. That'll be our next question. Well, actually, we've got Gadius first, but we have somebody, LC Lovecraft's Cat, wants us to comment on the Nicki Minaj story, which is a hilarious story. But first, let's go to Gadius. Gadius sends in $30, which is now 60, magically doubled. As white boy summer comes to an end, what will be the name for the upcoming season? Aryan Autumn. Faustian Fall, yeah. Well, endless white boy summer. Why not just have summer all year round? There's certainly places in the world where that's sort of like that. Unfortunately, they're increasingly flooded with the dark masses. I'm thinking Southern California.
I think the Beach Boys need to get radicalized and do an album called Endless White Boy Summer.
Yeah, that would be great. Yeah. Well, anyway, I don't know. It's a funny joke. Folks, if you have some thoughts about what we should call autumn now that it's almost upon us, share it in the chat, and we will definitely comment on it further in the course of the stream. So LC wants us to share our thoughts about Nicki Minaj. Jim, have you followed this at all?
I mean, the vax stuff just gives me a headache. I'm officially agnostic on it. I know they're lying, and you know, but I'm not certain exactly what they're lying about and exactly what they're not lying about. And I, again, that will make me unpopular. But I read some tweets you said about, you know, they want black people to just be quiet and stick marbles up their our asses. And I thought that was kind of more clever than I thought Nicki Minaj could be. Maybe Cardi B is the real dumb one. But yeah, she heard, you know, friend of a cousin, or, you know, had swollen testicles because of the vaccine and got eaten pretty much. But, you know, she will probably apologize on some level if she hasn't already and still have a career.
I don't know if she's apologized yet, but
she has not apologized.
Yeah, this has started on Twitter. Folks, if you don't know the story, there's a link that will magically appear in the chat on DLive, I hope, to Travel Blanc's recent piece about it, which came out yesterday. There's some background there. But Nicki Minaj is what? Some rapper? Some black girl or partly black girl who's a rapper? I've never heard her music, and I'm not going to seek it out. But anyway, she's famous. I just never heard of her before, but she's famous. And she's got a mouth on her. And anyway, and like many black women, whatever occurs to them in their brains comes right out of their mouths. And in her case, she tweets it out. And so she was talking about some cousin in Trinidad or whatever who got swollen testicles because of the vaccine. And she's not going to take it until she preys on it and researches it and makes up her own mind. And she got absolutely dogpiled by these left-wing bully types who don't want black people to go off the plantation, as Republicans like to say. But here's the thing. The left is in a terrible quandary because they are pushing vaccination and they want to demonize as evil people, those who don't want to get vaccinated. And yet the people who are most resistant to vaccination in America are magical Negroes that they want to elevate as semi-divine beings that we should all take our cues from. And so Nicki Minaj is a problem for them because isn't she a woman of color? Shouldn't we bow down and worship her? Shouldn't we shut up? Shouldn't white people shut up and let her talk? Right. Well, she's saying the wrong thing. And so they got some other black woman, Joy Reid, to mock her and attack her, to shut her up. And she's done a lot of great things. She tweeted about Tucker Carlson defending her. And then when some weird guy, I'm sure he's gay, named Hassan Piker, went after her. She tweeted this thing out, which saying he's a white nationalist, right? You know, he's a white nationalist. And her response was, right, I can't speak to, agree with, even look at someone from a particular political party. People aren't human anymore. If you're black and a Democrat tells you to shove marbles up your ass, you simply have to. If another party gets you to look out for that bus, stand there and get hit. Well, she's pretty much gotten the partisanship, the rabid, insane partisanship, and the expectation that blacks will always go along with what the Democrats want. It's actually pretty gutsy stuff. And
yeah, she called Joy Reid Uncle Tommy Anna, too.
Yeah, I love that.
White people to get this attitude.
Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely.
We picked up all the bad part of the culture, like, you know, rap music, cussing, like, let's get the attitude. That would be nice. Instead of like, oh, back the blue and we can't, oh, we have to apologize for everything. She just went off unhinged. And she's like, yesterday she's actually doxing journalist scum and posting their phone numbers and calling them like a hoe. So I say anyone who like shames journalists is a friend of mine. Like, I hate journalists. This is awesome.
Yeah.
That's one of the benefits of purity spiraling is there's always going to be somebody more radical than they are. And sooner or later, they're going to turn people off and probably flip them just by being too extreme. You know, that's one of the tiny good things about how far the left has gone.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that has to be talked about here, and I think more people will see through this because of this insane moralism. Now, I believe, okay, I'm not a nihilist. I'm not a relativist. I actually believe that there are moral facts, and you can have valid moral arguments, and that there are real obligations, crushing duties that we should live up to, et cetera, et cetera. But I also recognize that there's a certain class of people that, and they're basically nihilists. They're basically people who are subjectivists, and they're enormously selfish people who seize on morals as a way of basically venting their viciousness, lording it over other people, feeling good about themselves, putting other people down, etc. And the whole vaccine thing and the unvaccinated, you know, the unvaccinated are now moral lepers, right? The insane, unhinged moralism, the gloating about people who get sick, who anti-vaxxers who get sick, they deserve to die, right? The insane gloating and moralism about, what's his name? Rogan. When he decided to take ivermectin. Liberals are really nasty assholes when you just get right down to it. They're really nasty assholes, but they're also fake because they don't want to own up to the fact that they're nasty assholes. They want to be nasty assholes and feel good about themselves and be better than you. And I think we have to unmask that. We have to unmask moralism whenever it's simply a tool by which assholes engage in sadistic put-downs against other people and raise themselves up.
I'd say that's 90% of moralism, though.
I would say, certainly 90% of Twitter moralism. Maybe 99% of Twitter moral.
I think a lot of people use morality as a shield to hide their nastiness.
And a spear to express.
People that I would rate the most ethical that I've known in my life, they never grandstand about morality. They just go about being quietly ethical.
Yeah. Well, it's just like high school. At this point, it's like petty high school drama. These people never grew up, really. Like all these people who became prosecutors for January 6th, vaccine pushers, middle management, they still have a high school mentality. They never matured.
Yeah, and yeah. I guess Laura Loomer has COVID now, and I saw people gloating about her dying, and I guess that's wrong, too.
Yeah.
Well, I mean,
as annoying as she can be. Like, yeah, I mean, but just, yeah, but it's, and I don't think they see it. That's what I mean, though. When they have this ultimately righteous cause, you can gloat about someone dying a slow death and feel okay about it. That's something that baffles me about the human mind. It's that so many people are capable of that.
Yeah, and they feel absolutely no hesitation about being openly sadistic and bullying when they feel like they're on the right team. The Daily Beast put a headline out, Nicki Minaj won't get vaxxed, says she's worried about swollen testicles. And she just took after the media. You know, these people are paid liars. Yeah, I loved it. She's really a feisty black woman. Cynthia McKinney, who is a congresswoman from Georgia, is this way too. She ran, her father was a politician in Georgia, and so she ran for Congress. And she was immediately approached by all these power brokers, disproportionately a Jewish bunch of people in the Democratic Party. And they had all these deals for her. We will give you this and this and this, but you have to sign away your soul and say you'll support Israel forever. And she called them on this. She said no. And the thing is that it was only Cynthia McKinney and another black man. I think his name was Earl Hilliard or Hillier from Alabama. They're the only two people who got this deal and said no. Everybody else went along with it. And that would include people like Ron Paul and people like that. So this is fascinating. And she, for whatever reason, was missing that element of how to say, prudence, or maybe we should just call it cowardice, that everybody else has in the society. She spoke out about this, and she continues to speak out about it. Her career in Congress was short, but she continues to speak very frankly about the power of the Jewish lobby in America, and its systematic corruption of the U.S. government. I absolutely respect people like that.
There's a part of Route 10 in Atlanta here is renamed Cynthia McKinney Parkway.
Well, I hope that lasts as long as Lindbergh Drive.
They're trying to rename it back to just Route 10.
Yeah. Well, there's a Lindbergh Drive in Atlanta. I used to live in Atlanta. Lindbergh Drive goes through the most Jewish neighborhood in Atlanta. And every year there's kvetching and oy-veying about the evil anti-Semite and isolationist Lindbergh, and how it's just an insult to the Jewish community that his drive goes right through their heart. You know, it's like a stake through their heart. And they still haven't gotten it changed yet. Eventually, it'll probably happen because they never stop. They never let up. They never take a weekend from trying to erase our history.
There's a Charles Lindbergh airport in Orange County that they're trying to change too. And it's like, just let it be. But that was one of the last ones we targeted, but I think its days are numbered.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, as the demographics change, it'll be renamed after some aviator from south of the Rio Grande, perhaps, and anything just to get Lindbergh's name off it. I think Minaj is a great story. I was very, very impressed with her. Unknown Californian writes in with $3. Thank you very much. That's doubled to $6. I'm really enjoying the Saturday streams. My wife, my 2-year-old, and I are cleaning house and listening to this fascinating conversation. Keep up the great work, panel. Well, thank you very much, and we appreciate your support. I'm going to check in with our DLive folks and see if they have anything more to add to the conversation. Well, we've gotten more ice creams, Norse Nature, 14 lemons. Andrew King has donated a Ninjagini. I very much appreciate that. But we are over 200 viewers, folks. If you would shill the stream, share the stream, we'll get up to 300 or 400. We have changed days, and that means we're going to lose some people, but we will gain new people. And I definitely want this to be a success because, like I said, I had to change this because of my nap. So great. I don't see any questions here. Let's go back to entropy and see if we've got some new stuff. Unknown Californian with $10. What do you think of people like Joe Rogan or JP Sears, who seem to mock liberals and the left's lunacy and tyranny, but also promote Black Rifle Coffee and espouse Gandhi and MLK? I'm not sure if they're gateways to our side or gatekeepers. Well, let's talk about gateways and gatekeepers. I think that's a great question to talk about. Why don't you go first, Jim? Do you have any thoughts on how do we interpret people as gateways or gatekeepers?
I used this metaphor a while ago about, because when they were trying to purge all the wig gnats or whatever, I said it's better to look at it as a bee colony, and different people serve different roles, you know, and a lot of people aren't ready for the protocols of the Elders of Zion immediately. And you kind of have to nudge them that way. I think the best thing that's driving people in this direction is just how crazy the left is acting these days. Like Nicki Minaj might just post in an SS uniform next week for a photo shoot.
Actually, she is.
I think their behavior is more persuasive than any of our propaganda could possibly be. But I think everyone serves a role, and people. A lot of people are dumb and not discerning, and they're easily brainwashed no matter who the gatekeeper is. But, you could use the drug metaphor. Marijuana was the gateway drug, and then you move on to other things. Like, that's kind of a bad metaphor, but a lot of people just aren't ready for unvarnished truth. So I think any level of it's okay, as long as it's not the officially sanctioned propaganda that you're getting from academia and the media and the government.
Right.
I don't have a problem with it.
What do you think, Thomas?
Well, going back, it's kind of funny real quick to what you said about Nicki Minaj possibly doing something in optical. Her several years ago, she did a song called Only, and it was full unoptical regime, authoritarian 1930s optics, like full out there. So she was already kind of a fireball, looks like.
Well, that's fascinating. And her career hasn't been shelved because of that. So she might continue for a bit. Doing this kind of stuff. Eventually, people are going to try and threaten her and rein her in, but then they're worried right now that she's going to go Cynthia McKinney on them and tell the whole world about the deal, right? So you got to be really, really careful. If you're going to come to somebody with an offer they can't refuse, you got to be sure that they're not crazy enough to just rat on you to the public. And she's got a huge following. She's got, hundreds of thousands of people following her on various social media platforms. So unless they're going to do a coordinated takedown of her social media and just silence her, like the coincidental takedown of Alex Jones, then I think there's a real danger that she would just blurt out what's happening.
Her net worth is $85 million, so I'm not sure she really cares.
Yeah. Of course, there is a great line. This was years ago. This was like 2003. My God, it was when The Passion of the Christ came out, and at the very last minute, Mel Gibson did cuck on one thing and removed a line from the Bible because Jews were upset about it. He removed "His blood will be on us and our children" line. The line that they objected to most from Holy Scripture, no less. He took some of God's words and censored them out. And N.B. Forrest, who was a commentator at Vanguard News Network, said, "How many hundreds of millions of dollars do you need before you can give the Jews the finger?" It's a really good question. How rich do you have to be before you feel like you can give these people the finger? Well, we might find out how rich Nicki Minaj feels that she needs to be to give these people the finger. So,
well, at least they kept in the Mel Gibson line where they call Mary Magdalene sugar tits. I admired that.
I don't remember that. the gateway versus gatekeeper thing. I've written a number of things about this kind of stuff. A couple of pieces on the topic of punching right, for one, and another thing, a couple things about the alt-light and about the Milo question. I'm forgetting which pieces these were, frankly, at this point, because it's so long ago. But here are a few thoughts. Even if somebody wants to be a gatekeeper. And in a way, everybody wants to be a gatekeeper because if you really believe the stuff that you say, then you're going to say, well, these people who disagree with me are wrong and I'm not going to promote wrong ideas. So I do that, right? I believe the things that I want to believe and I don't want to support things that are wrong, that promote wrong things. There are people on the right, though, who have this strange attitude of entitlement. It's almost infantile, where they think that people closer to the mainstream should not just promote the things that they actually believe in, but they should not say anything negative about, you know, guys further to the right. I don't see where they get this sense of entitlement. One of the things that goes along with this sense of entitlement is this idea that, well, these people are actually dishonest. They actually really do believe what we believe, but they're being dishonest and pretending not to. Often, that's not the case. In fact, I think it's vanishingly unlikely that that's the case most of the time. The truth is that the reason why people closer to the mainstream say they disagree with us is because they actually disagree with us. And we shouldn't treat other people disagreeing with us as a personal affront or some kind of a nefarious activity on their part. We should just treat this as an opportunity to change minds. And if we don't think that these people are honest and can be persuaded, That's all well and good. But the fact is that many of their followers are open-minded. And that the best way to approach it then is to argue with these people as if they're arguing in good faith, and to try and bring over as many of their followers as possible. So you might think that they're a gatekeeper, but they can still be a gateway if you use them properly. And instead of having this entitled attitude that you think that these people should be promoting not just their ideas, but your ideas too, and then feel angry that they're not, as if anybody would do that ever in the real world, you should just go about this as an opportunity to spread your views and to argue for your views. And if there are people who are relatively close to you and they're promoting, say, ideas that you can actually run with and build upon, I think it's foolish to sniff at them and think they're controlled opposition. Even if they are trying to be controlled opposition, if they promote things that we can build upon, they're actually helping us. But right. Whether they help us or not is up to us. We shouldn't be demanding that they help us. We should be taking the onus of that upon ourselves and making something out of the situation. That's the adult way of going about it.
I also think, like Hemingway said about bankruptcy, it happens gradually, then all of a sudden. I don't think people suddenly get like a head injury and go all George Lincoln Rockwell. It's usually, like a clamshell, their heads are pried open gradually. So yeah, I think attacking the gatekeepers kind of turns off the gatekeepers, may turn off their followers. These people will come around, like I said, reality will do it better than any of us can. But being a purity spiraling grump, I don't think helps anybody.
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I think the best policy is, if they treat us honorably, we treat them honorably. If they treat us dishonorably, we retaliate and kind of try to destroy. And Charlie Kirk has always treated us dishonorably, backbiting, has tried to dox America First people. In stark contrast, you have E. Michael Jones, who debated Jared Taylor, who was supposed to be an untouchable bad boy. But they had a nice debate. Of course, Jared Taylor won bigly. And I think if we're, E. Michael Jones never dealt with us dishonorably, Jared Taylor dealt with him honorably. I think anyone who's kind of on the fence and heard E. Michael Jones' theory about conflation of category and it's about religion, not race, wouldn't buy it, and they're going to come naturally to us as long as we're not being nasty towards E. Michael Jones.
But I thought E. Michael Jones was entirely dishonorable and strayed way off the topic and is just an unpleasant person. So I'll disagree on that.
Well, he wasn't at least trying to dox us. At least he showed up. We've had people, I think other people have had the gatekeepers bounce upon them, or they've tried to dox them, or they'll smear them, but they add a homonym. At least E. Michael Jones, he's arguing an indefensible position, so I think he had to do all this Talmudic high verbal reasoning. But of course, Jared Taylor just kind of wiped the floor with him, and that was very, I think, persuasive to people who might have been on the fence.
Right, because Jared Taylor was not nasty like E. Michael Jones was. I think that he was much more genteel about it. Every time E. Michael Jones debates someone, he starts screaming.
Honestly, it's going to deal like the Turning Point USA crowd, where they'll get very Charlie Kirk screaming at people on camera, trying to dox them. So it's weird how my standards have fallen because this, how horrible the controlled gatekeepers are, I guess.
Mm-hmm. I do think that if we look like the classy adult people in the room and the other side is reduced to screaming, that is a bigger win in some ways than having the best arguments. Because again, people are not entirely rational. We're not just brains in a vat. We're not just looking at the logic of positions and weighing things. We're also looking at people, and I do think that people are persuasive by just how they act. Their character comes out, and Aristotle talks about this when he talks about rhetoric, that there's the argument, the logos, as a word that E. Michael Jones loves, but you also are persuaded by the pathos of the speaker, their emotions and their ethos, their character. And if you're going to have a well-rounded approach to persuasion, you have to come off as a honorable person, and you have to stir the emotions of your audience. But you shouldn't come off as hysterical yourself at the same time. And I think Jared did a really good job of that. And if we can do that, if we're the ones who are being calm and dignified, and the Charlie Kirks of the world are melting down, again, that's a great argument, in quotes, in and of itself. That is highly persuasive. And I think that we're going to get to those situations more often if we remain calm, if we debate these people in good faith, if we're as patient with them as possible, if we assume, at least as a tactic, that they're honorable and being honest and things like that. If we go into it with that kind of mindset and then they disappoint us, that's great, because they're disappointing their followers too, and they're disappointing a lot of people who are persuadable. And that's good. But if you go into this with the sort of paranoid and entitled attitude about these people, like, these people should be making my arguments for me, and if they're not, they're evil. That, I think, if you give off that vibe, you undermine your credibility in the eyes of normies, in the eyes of the unpersuaded, the persuadable. And we shouldn't do that.
I mean, you know, as much of a goofball as Charlie Kirk and his ilk are, I think anyone who just says the mainstream narrative is a lie is valuable on some level. He's got a giant audience. Some of those people will go, you know, that's just a lily pad for the frogs to hop on en route to this way, I think. I mean, yeah, I don't think I've ever heard Charlie Kirk speak. I just know who he is, and he has a huge following. And like I said, anyone who's just saying what they're telling you on any level is a lie is useful to some degree.
Yeah, I agree with that. One thing that you wrote this week, Jim, that I just thought was very touching and really a great piece, was your piece on Norm MacDonald.
Yes.
Not only did I not know that he was sick, I didn't even know he was dead until I got that piece. And yeah. I have to say that I've never been a SNL person, but I knew Norm MacDonald, and I thought he was a genuinely hilarious guy.
Nobody like him. I mean, my first exposure was on SNL. Like, I just, you know, wandered. I mean, I think the only good season was the first one, 1975, when Michael O'Donoghue was the chief writer, Mr. Mike, because he had this dark, death-like sense of humor. I write in the article that Michael O'Donoghue was a writer at the National Lampoon. He had a column called Children's Letters to the Gestapo. And one of the letters was, "Dear Mr. Goebbels, how do you fit those Jews in your ovens? My parents can hardly get a pot roast in ours." Norm MacDonald, I mean, he did this thing about Brando. And it was just a news piece. He's like, Marlon Brando was run out of Hollywood for saying the Jews control Hollywood. And then he met with some Jewish leaders and apologized, and they said, "You can work again." And all he did was report the truth, but that was the joke. Because basically, they proved that what Marlon Brando was saying had some weight. And absolutely, he was one of the only ones in the title. Like, I didn't even know he was sick. This great bit, and I could only find like a chunk of it. He had this idiot co-host, Adam Egan, on the podcast that he did. And they're talking, Adam Egan's talking about 420. You don't know what 420 is, this marijuana holiday. And Norm probably knew what it was doing, but he played dumb. He was like the smartest guy ever to play dumb. And he looks up 420 and he's reading, and he pretends he doesn't know who Hitler is. He's like, 420, April 20th is the birthday of Austrian politician and leader of the National Socialist Party, a fella by the name of Adolf Hitler. Huh. I got a picture of this Hitler guy. Very, very compelling looking. Odd looking duck. His eyes are almost completely black. Huh. He fought in World War I. He got, hold the fort. He hated Jews. I hate these guys like Hitler. We got to go kill Hitler. Suicide mission. And his dumb co-host, I think, was not aware he was being messed with. He's like, well, I think he died like 50 years ago. And he goes, really? I didn't even know he was sick. But that was Norm was the only kind doing that sense of humor, had that kind of humor at any kind of following. And I also linked to he did the White House press correspondents dinner, like Bill Clinton there. And he did this joke about Madeleine Albright. She was like, you send me all over here to talk to this Meshuggah guy, Yeltsin? What are you talking? And got away with it in front of the president of the United States. No one else was doing that. But he just saw the irony and the hypocrisy and what you weren't supposed to say. And I guess fascinated in the same way I am. I don't understand taboos. Why are some things unspeakable? It's usually for a dumb reason. There's a lot of comedy to be mined from that. And I can't think of anybody who was as good as he was at doing it. And the first thing I caught in SNL, he was talking about the Labor Department. Someone came out with a report about the best jobs. And now for the third year in a row, the worst job, crack whore. And he would just say it with this upbeat tempo and this kind of malevolent gleam in his eye. There was really nobody I can compare to Norm at this point. I mean, Don Rickles, I think, was the best stand-up of all time. He died 4 years ago. Now Norm's gone. The world is a lot less funny now. And you can't have a career as a comedian telling those kind of jokes anymore.
Absolutely, yeah. Do you have any thoughts on Norm MacDonald, Thomas?
Unfortunately, I wish I had watched more TV back when it was cool, but I did like the part in your article when you said that he seemed to think that if the audience don't like the joke, that was their problem, not his. Yeah. I like that attitude.
Perfect.
That's perfect.
He didn't pander at all. He actually, I think, liked it more when the audience didn't like the joke.
Yeah.
Because when he did the White House press, and I think that's available on YouTube, like there was a lot of things he was saying they did not laugh at, but he was laughing at every joke he told.
Nice.
And he went on The View those hens of The View. He just said, Bill Clinton, he's a killer. At least we don't have I like President Bush. We don't have a killer in office. And they would tell him to shut up. And he's just smiling, wouldn't shut up about it. Great comedian. He understood like the value in poking at taboos because taboos are dumb and they're a comic goldmine.
Yeah.
But I mean, the comedians these days toe the line. None of them really address it because they're attacking old taboos that really aren't taboos anymore.
Yeah, I remember years ago, the Jerusalem Post or something did a Holocaust cartoon competition. They wanted cartoons mocking the Holocaust. And it was fascinating because none of them were funny. And the reason that none of them were funny is because none of the cartoons actually were making fun of the Holocaust. They were making fun of basically politically incorrect views about the Holocaust. And I thought it was fascinating how systematic that was. The inability to... I mean, there are a lot of people who can dish it out, namely mockery, but they can't take it. They can't take it. And... I think that's fascinating. And if you can't take mockery though, can you really be funny? It's an interesting question. One of the things that I'm fascinated by is the question, why is something funny? Why do we laugh at things? And one of the writers that Countercurrents has promoted for years, ever since the start, Anthony Ludovici, he has a theory about laughter, and he goes, it's kind of grinding the way he goes through all these different examples of funny things, but he comes up with the most interesting, varied list of funny things. And then he says, okay, now I'm going to come up with a theory that explains all of these things, why all of these things are funny. And his theory about laughter is basically, it's based in evolutionary biology. And he says that laughter is basically a feeling of superior fitness, that you laugh at things because you feel above them, you feel superior to them. And if you can't feel above them, if you can't feel superior, if you're insecure, if you have an inferiority complex, with the things that you're dealing with, you can't really laugh at them. Now, there is the phenomenon of fake laughter or nervous laughter, which is an attempt to fake laughter because it's an attempt to fake a feeling of superiority that you don't have. And one of the things, though, about the left increasingly is they're not very, you know, we love to talk about how the left can't meme. But one of the things that they can't do is, in more general, is they're not funny anymore. I mean, the mainstream isn't very funny. They're laughable, but they themselves aren't funny. And they're not funny because I think they've lost, I think they're deeply inferior people. They're deeply insecure people. They're frightened people. That means that they're not capable of really being funny. They're capable of being vicious, right? But they're not capable of being funny.
I think it's cyclical. I don't think the mainstream is ever funny, no matter what side of the spectrum is in charge. I think that's kind of how it works. I think a lot of the humor is just from poking at what's sacred to any given society.
Mm-hmm.
But I watched, there's a great interview, Dick Cavett interviewed Alfred Hitchcock. It's on YouTube. And he was talking about horror movies, and he said they're like roller coasters where you dip and you're screaming. But he noticed like everyone's scared out of their minds, but they get off the roller coaster giggling. I think there's a lot of uncomfortable laughter, just like Norm Macdonald, he, you know, Hitler and death and Jews and everything else you're not supposed to laugh at that people are afraid of. But he just he kind of cracked that wide open.
Mm-hmm.
I think you saw it too a little bit in South Park, because South Park, they were edgy. They would always have the professor is like the main joke of what was taboo. Like the professor became tranny, but then trannies became mainstream. So it's like, what do we do? I forgot how they dealt with the professor, but they lost their sparkle. Like I think they should have like ended the show years ago and just kept, you know, their gains and not tarnish it, but it just has become unfunny. It's like they used to make fun of people being preachy, like you're being preachy, but now they feel kind of preachy, so I don't watch it anymore. But how the mighty have fallen.
I mean, you can lay down truths without being preachy. I think that's the value of comedy. That's why a lot of very few preachers are funny.
Yeah.
So one thing that I would love to talk about that we haven't commented on at Countercurrents yet, although we have a piece in the pipeline, and I'll let everybody know about it, just to tease you with it. Morris V. DeCamp, who likes to write on military matters, has a piece on Mark Milley. I'm looking forward to reading that, and we'll run it in the new week. But again, this is an absolutely fascinating case study in the decline of the American establishment. Here we have this general who he was all for critical race theory, and he's massively PC, as it turns out. And he's now been revealed to have been on the phone with the Red Chinese, saying, "Hey guys, don't worry. You know, I'll let you know if the United States is going to launch an attack." First of all, he was so dumb and paranoid, and I guess gaslighted by the media, and he had a real case of Trump derangement syndrome. He actually thought Donald Trump was going to could start nuclear war with the Chinese, which is just incredibly stupid in and of itself. But then to go and basically start making phone calls with his opposites in the Chinese military, saying that he's going to give away the game if the U.S. wants to go to war. I mean, that's treason. This guy needs to be court-martialed. At the very least, he needs to be removed from his position. But then it turns out that this guy was partially responsible for basically saying that, you know, the United States military, Trump could have used the military to suppress BLM. And we were all wondering why. Well, my basic assumption was that the military was in danger of revolt, of insubordination, if he tried this, because you can't use the military against sacred, numinous black people, even when they're burning cities down. Well, it turns out that there's a lot of truth to that, and that Milley was one of the guys responsible for this too. So what are your thoughts on this? We'll go to Thomas first.
Sure. So first of all, there's a lot to unpack here. Milley is just a basket case, but I think, like you said, like the military couldn't be trusted to crack down on BLM. There's a huge divide between the functional part of military, which is usually white, male, enlisted, and everyone else. So people who would actually go out and like put down these savages who are burning our cities would be happy to do so. It'd just be all the little paper pushers whining. And yes, there are a lot of mall cops. It depends what troops you're using. Are you using active duty troops, or unfortunately, guard and reserve are a disaster. Like, I've seen reservists or guardsmen come to my base and it looked like they were going to destroy the sit-up bars because they were so fat and they were flopping about. Like, all the pictures you saw back during BLM when they were deploying the troops, they really are that pathetic. But if you actually had real enlisted men and had some type of way you could deploy them instead of guard reserve, it would have been no problem. They would have loved it. Second thing is that just shows that the brass really understands who their real boss is and that there's no real consequences for them, which sets a dangerous precedent. Milley is a psychopathic careerist. He would not have done this if he thought he could not get away with it, or at least be like 95% certain he could. So this kind of shows that there he knew that the derp state, as I call them, I'm not going to call them deep state and dignify them, but he knew that people would have his back in D.C. And really shows that really Trump was never fully commander-in-chief. Because, like, I think Jimmy said, like, this has been going on for a long time. It has, like, all the stuff we're seeing, it didn't just pop up under Biden. It began really, it accelerated under Obama. Then Trump came in, but Trump never put his foot down like a man. He was just kind of like a henpecked husband who let the brass and all these weirdos who got it, you know, they settled in. They spread their mycelium, their fungi, and this kind of like took over and corrupted it. And Trump would have had to done a major purge of the military, and he didn't have the guts to do it. And then two, it's, yeah, going back to it, just like there's no accountability for the brass. Like during the drone strike debriefing, they had no sense of accountability for that either. There was this Marine general talking to military speak and just giving this apology that sounded like, you know, sorry, but, and everyone knows that a sorry, but's not a real sorry. And two, the deep state, like, part of the reasons is that, you know, General Milley is neurotic. He is Trump derangement syndrome, but really generals as a whole are neurotic. It's not just because of the diversity libtard issue. It's joked that to be a general, you have to basically only sleep 4 hours a night. There's all this paperwork, all this buffoonery and patty cake, which is not about putting warheads on forts. It's about like little patty cake paper pushing, which they have like aide-de-camps do, but for some reason, it's exploded. It's almost very metaphysical, like someone else, some metaphysical power made everyone go crazy with bureaucracy. So in my opinion, every general is mentally unstable for no other reason than they do not sleep like a normal person and they're obsessed with their job. So with a person like that, they're not going to be cultured. So of course, Milley, it's little wonder he goes into CRT. He probably has never read a real Western book. Like he probably has never read Nietzsche. He's never read anything good. It's just like, rah, 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 operation this and that. So he's not a real officer. Like during the Napoleonic era, officers were supposed to be these cultured avatars of their people instead of these, you know, bureaucrats. And so it's, they're all, the whole military too is isolated as a whole from the rest of society. That's an ongoing issue, but the brass, it's even more intense, the isolation. They do get stuck in echo chambers. They don't realize how, frankly, retarded they sound to everybody else. Now, of course, people who are less in that culture, who might just be in the first term enlistment, they're not likely to re-enlist. So Milley's just kind of like a basket case of all these issues, but really distilled into one disgusting excuse for a human being.
One thing that a lot of people on the right think, it's just an instinct that they have. They think, well, if there is a deep state, and by a deep state, what I mean is sort of a last line of defense, people who identify fully with the survival of the nation and the system and are willing to kill and die for it. Well, you'd think that you'd find those people in the military if nowhere else. And then to see that the military is full of these goofy careerist types who it's just a racket to them. To see them eyeing their exit and getting board positions in defense contractors. It's such a racket. These people are engaged in a racket.
It nukes morale.
Yeah, and beyond that, what's going on is they're not really identifying with the interests of the nation. They're identifying with their own interests, and one of the ways that they feather their own nests is by not resisting politically correct nonsense from the general culture. They go along with that. Why? Not because it makes the military better at doing its job, but because it makes their jobs easier. They're paid well, and then it helps them ease their way into these cushy positions once they leave.
There's actually a huge racket for uniform production. So all these ex-generals, they go to these like uniform production companies. So every few years, the uniform changes for each service because these generals want to make big bucks off it. So it's a literal racket.
That's fascinating. I wish the uniforms actually looked better. I mean, I remember the first Gulf War, and you would see generals doing briefings dressed in these desert fatigues. They might as well have been wearing pajamas. It's just, these shapeless blob uniforms are all very drab looking. I can't take a military like that very seriously.
We had German infantrymen in World War I were more stylish than people in modern garrison duty. Like, if on the worst ones, probably Army. Their current like battle dress is just kind of like you wear every day is just like disgusting. It's a sack. And then their dress uniform is kind of a disaster.
Yeah, I wonder if that's sort of influenced by egalitarianism too, and by the lowering standards of recruits. If you're just all going to dress them in shapeless, sack-like uniforms, they all basically look the same. You can't really tell who's fit and who's not. Some of these National Guard people who were showed up to guard the Capitol from the insurrectionists were grossly out of shape looking people.
Yeah, and that was before
they hide them in the sack,
Yeah, and that was before they've had year and a half. Where are we on? Like year and a half of COVID, where they we can't PT, and then like two. There are things that these slobs are going to get vaccinated. So their PT ability is probably going to go down a little bit. They were already having issues. I saw multiple PT failures for a simple test. Trying to get these slobs to pass a PT test is going to be like pulling teeth. PT meaning physical training. It's like, can you run and do push-ups, but bad form, actually. It's pretty basic. Mm-hmm. And this is important because if we go to war, the U.S. government goes to war with China, you're going to need infantrymen who cannot, get out, start gasping for air because of the vaccine. And you need pilots. Pilots will be a huge part of this. And flying is difficult. Flying, altitude, maneuvers, all that stuff. The human body is not built to really do it. So if you mess with their physiology just a little bit, their performance will go down. It's not just a metal weapon system. There's a human aspect of that weapon system, of the jet fighter, of the bomber. They may not be able to do maneuvers, in my opinion. They might. So our aerial capability, which is a huge part of our standoff meaning we can shoot them without being shot back or take casualties because, we can't take a single hit without crying. That's going to go down because all the pilots will not be able to fly properly. They're going to be probably messed up to some degree physically or mentally.
Yeah, this is interesting. Again, it may be later than we think for America. But for me, and I'm very skeptical about the people who think, well, we'll just have a military coup or something. It's like,
no,
I'm sorry. The military basically the military brass basically are bureaucrats who might watch Fox News. But now we know that they're bureaucrats who are watching CNN and taking all this to heart. That's
absolutely. There was actually at my base, at the dental office, or one of the personnel offices, all these support staffs you have to go to. They had a TV during Trump's presidency. It was almost always CNN. It was not Fox News. So the CNN was there bad-mouthing every single day the commander-in-chief on base. And there's no guidance or push. You know, maybe we should switch it up or put on at least Fox News. You know, it's always CNN propaganda, which I think is amazing, allowing enemy propaganda to brainwash your troops on base.
Yeah, when was the last time that the military actually pushed back against progressivism and political correctness?
Honestly, never. It was always, I think, Trump. He was not in the military. He's a civilian. He pushed back against the tranny thing, and the military pushed back against his pushback. You had the so-called chief master sergeant Air Force, who was black, play the race card to undermine Trump. He's like, well, he doesn't want Trump. I'm paraphrasing here, but he said something like, well, Trump doesn't want the trannies to serve, and there was once a time when people like me couldn't serve either. Mm-hmm. I was just like shocked, shell-shocked that this guy was mouthing off to his boss. But if I mouth off to my boss, I'd be in hot water. And Trump could have had all these people fired, disciplined, but he is too weak, too cowardly, and frankly lacked the willpower to get his military in control, which is ridiculous. If you're a free country, the military is subservient to the civilians, not the other way around.
Yeah, and this is something that the Milley thing brings up. The vaunted principle of civilian control over the military. Suddenly liberals have forgotten all about that, giving Milley high fives for basically being insubordinate against Trump. Now we're seeing the depth of this insubordination. And I've yet to see liberals really taking this seriously and thinking we cannot have a military coup. We cannot have an out of control military. It's a threat to our system. They don't see it as a threat. Well, why? Because they're myopic and they're blinded by partisanship, basically.
Yeah, it's like it's same with election fraud. Election fraud is great because it only works in their favor. A military coup will only probably work in their favor, so they think it's great.
And that's really astonishing when the left thinks that the military taking liberties is going to work in their favor. Well, they probably are right. They know the fix is in. And that's extremely alarming. One thing that is interesting to me is the question about the middle management in the military, or the middle management in corporations, or the middle management basically in any institution. When you get to the upper management, generally you get people who are cynical, jaded, and it's become a racket to them. And they're the people who are pushing, for instance, in the military, all the politically correct stuff, even though it makes the military less effective. You know, they betrayed whatever oaths they've taken, basically to defend the country, but because they're making the military less effective because they're basically kowtowing to political correctness. What about people, though, closer to the middle ranks? Are they as cynical? And the reason I ask is because there has been a history of colonels' coups. And generally, you find that if generals have a coup, it basically is reactionary. Meaning, and by reactionary, I mean basically it upholds the system. Whereas you've actually had radicals who are colonels taking over. I'm thinking of in Portugal, for instance, in the 70s, or there was a similar type of coup. These were left-wing coups in Peru. But the fact is that, for instance, in Latin America or in the Latin world, coups are always right-wing because they're always generals. And because they're establishment people, but by the time you're a general, you're an establishment person. But if you're middle rank, a lot of the people who are idealists, who have radical views, and who are not cynical and sold out yet, are still around, and they're looking at their superiors, and they're saying to themselves, "This is no way to run a country." Do you think there's any potential? Not just in the military, but say in middle management throughout society, for these people to displace the establishment?
I don't think they can displace the establishment because they're outnumbered, but they can definitely cause problems. I think a good illustration of that is Lieutenant Colonel Scheller. He's a Marine who basically said, there's been no accountability about Afghanistan. And then, of course, he's the only one held accountable for speaking up. He is removed from his command. However, he did say, hey, he is not backing down. He said something in a follow-up video like, follow me and we will bring the whole effing system down. So he's enraged and he will have people follow him. I'm not sure what his game plan is. It might be go run for office, do a strike, but they're in the civilian world. I've heard from my friends that their employer will try to make them get the vaccine. And then all the functional people will say, no, we're not. And then the employer backs off. And you can't fill these positions with Afghanis. That's just not going to work. The company will implode. The military, they still need competent people, but they were forced out. And I think really we're underestimating how many good people left under Obama. And right. I think increasingly from Obama onward, all the people who joined for the right reasons were viciously burnt out like I was first term. We're like, we will not re-enlist. This is ridiculous because they talk about these high ideals, but then like do the exact opposite. So we're bouncing. Like we were the ones who were the most burnt out and depressed because it was such a shell shock. But I think they can do something. I don't think they can like launch a coup, but I think they can create some type of alternate protest movement, maybe. I don't want to say movement, but they're going to cause trouble somehow.
Yeah. What was the guy who is the Space Force fellow who was booted because he complained about critical race theory? I'm forgetting his name.
I forgot his name too, but I mean, it's something about aviation and white boys. You can't do aviation without white men. Even the maintainers who fix the planes are usually white men.
Right, right. So let's move on.
I wanted to say a couple of things about the National Guard.
Absolutely. Sure.
I just woke up. Ronald Reagan, when he was governor of California, called in the National Guard and squashed what was going on in Berkeley. The National Guard was sent out to Detroit in 1967, I believe, and squashed that pretty quickly. In 1992, I was living in Hollywood during the LA riots, and they sure calmed them down. Well, two things. The welfare checks came in, but the National Guard, I was driving to work, and you see sandbags and people with, like, tanks on the streets. The difference between then and now is it's an illusion that the military is here to serve the American people. The military is owned by the defense corporations and the globalists. Why would anyone want to join? Why would anyone who actually cares about the founding principles of America want to join an enterprise that seems hell-bent on destroying America? We could have won it. We could have blown Afghanistan into glass. There's a reason we didn't. I don't think it's their weak. I don't think that's what the people who direct the military wanted. I think it's as simple as that. I think the last military operation the U.S. won was the Gulf War. That was quick, done. I mean, they took over Iraq pretty quickly and then left. And, you know, everything's worse. I guess I have personal stake in this. My brother's mine was destroyed in a losing war in Vietnam. My dad came home an alcoholic from World War II just for his son to be called a Nazi. I don't really see the point of it. I can't really think of the last war I would have supported. Maybe, you know, the Revolutionary War, they should have let the South go in the Civil War, all of it. Otherwise, I don't get really too involved with it. I'll just fight on the streets. Otherwise, because I don't see the U.S. military representing anything that I'm interested in.
It is very interesting. The regime is now basically declaring that people like us are the number one enemy.
Right.
It's not Black Lives Matter. It's not Antifa. It's people like us. And we have to be quite prepared because although they will go easy on people who are trashing the system like blacks, they will not go easy on us. And they're really looking for a lot of great white defendants, basically. And if they can't find them, they'll manufacture them. And we're in a very dangerous situation right now, which is why we really have to be very, very careful. This goes back to the question about public protests again. There were protests today about the January 6th protesters being mistreated. And I wonder what percentage of the people in that crowd we're feds. The trouble with the guys on the right now, going for the fash cuts is like everybody looks like they're a narc at these rallies. It's very dangerous to get involved in anything like this, and which is why I kind of want to encourage people to keep their heads down for a while and not cooperate in being framed, because there's going to be absolutely no toleration for people like us. And we can see that with the treatment of these January 6th protesters, which is genuinely horrific. We do objectively have political prisoners in the United States, simply because for some people, the laws are not applied. And for others, with the wrong politics, they get the book thrown at them.
Yep, I sincerely hope that some of those political prisoners become future leaders and this really bites regime in the butt, because all you need is one or two of those to, they have street cred. All you need is one or two intelligent prisoners to decide they're going to dedicate their life to bringing down the system, and people will follow them. Like, they have created martyrs.
Yeah, there is some truth to that. The next Nelson Mandela, but of a very different kind, might be rotting away in one of these jails right now. We can hope. We can at least hope. I am going to give one more look over at Entropy. Unknown Californian has sent $3. That is six now. And he says the Honorable William Luther Pierce was born on September 11th, 1933. Keep him in your thoughts. Well, yeah, it's very easy to remember his birthday because of course, what happened on September 11th, 20 years ago. Jim, what are your thoughts on the way that was marked recently by the regime, September 11th, the 20th anniversary?
I don't pay too much attention to what the president is doing at any time. They were basically apologizing for Islamophobia and saying that whites are the chief, white domestics are the main terrorists. Am I wrong about that? Or,
well, George W. Bush made a speech.
Right, right.
Robert Hampton talked about it.
I mean, sickening, especially, the lives cost. And one thing that people never really talk about is, all these guys coming home, we're going to have a bunch of Travis Bickles. You're going to have some massive PTSD cases going crazy and, mass shootings and suicides. It's disgusting. But, I was never a big Bush guy as it was. This is how I remember September 11th. I was fresh out of the pokey. I was in Portland. When it happened, even the most radical anarchist communist crust punk for the first month or two was waving an American flag and saying, we got to go kill all those Muslims. I was the only guy saying, well, what do you expect? You starved a million Iraqi women and children to death, and you've messed around in the Middle East for decades. I'm not saying it, in this karmic sense, like we deserved it or fuck around and find out. But there are, I believe, in cause and effect. I don't think the U.S. has really ever had an interest in the Middle East, maybe oil, but I think it's obvious whose interests the U.S. is protecting in the Middle East, and it's not the U.S.'s interests. So I'm like, what did you expect to happen? That's how I commemorated it. Everyone, claiming Islamophobe, it's just maybe that wasn't the aim in the first place. Maybe there are string pullers that, what is it, esoteric and exoteric? What they tell the people is not exactly what they're trying to do. That's how I look at all this Middle East meddling. God, it was 10 years ago for Tackies, I wrote an article, Who Cares About the Middle East? It's one of those things I sort of zone out because I don't see anything good out of any of it.
Yeah, I wrote a thing about the 10th anniversary of 9/11, and I just rerun it every year. And it has stuff in there about the Jewish lobby, trying to get the United States into another war. And I never change it because it's always true. They're still working at it. They're constantly trying to get us into some other war with one of Israel's enemies. And it's depressing. It's depressing to see that my stopped clock is definitely always right about the Israel lobby. So I just repeat the same piece every year. And now it's not 10 years, it's 20 years.
The original stated intent of going to Afghanistan was to get Osama bin Laden because they were hiding him, right? They could have done that with a special ops team. What they wanted to do was nation build and spread democracy. Because someone asked me this question, like, if we can't beat Afghanistan, what do you think sending troops on the southern border is going to do? As long as we don't try to take Mexico and rebuild it, it would keep illegal aliens, you know, and 10,000 Haitians from coming across the border. That they could do that easily, but the will is not there. And the people that are pulling the strings don't want that to happen.
Absolutely. Thomas, what are your thoughts on the 9/11 commemoration recently?
I thought it was interesting because apparently a lot of people who own a certain type of phone had a article pushed to them called like how 9/11 was the road to January 6th, which was pretty tone deaf. That was a very insulting thing to put out on September 11th because a lot of us lived through that. Like that was, like you said, Jim, like we were all together. It was kind of weird. Like it's almost surreal to remember time when we weren't at each other's throats like we are now. So that was like tone deaf. I think the regime is overplaying their propaganda. And two, William Luther Pierce, he made a good point, was that he predicted that all this war on terror was going to be used against us. And he was right. Just, I think it was yesterday in the court case for Kyle Rittenhouse, it was admitted that that there is a fixed wing spy plane of some type from the FBI over Kenosha that had infrared. And they basically were tracking the people down there, and they used, oh, look, Rittenhouse was here, and that's when the shooting happened, there's a skateboard. So if that thing had an infrared camera on it, what's to say didn't have signals intelligence? Signals intelligence meaning spy, basically, cell phone tracking, cell phone hacking. And if they felt they could get away with it, why not spy on Americans? I wouldn't be surprised if they were spying on Americans in Kenosha without a warrant, because it's a new war of terror. Another thing to piggyback off of what you said, like all the people coming home from PTSD, the Biden regime recently said that they want to deny VA benefits those who are veterans who are not vaccinated. Like they can't go into a doctor's appointment. That is going to cause a crisis because the people who are resisting the vaccine the most are usually the ground thumpers who aren't stupid. They have wisdom and common sense. Those guys are going to be screwed over.
Yeah. Well, let them screw over people who use guns. One of the dumbest things about liberals, the leftists, is they, and this goes back to declaring basically everybody who voted for Trump, you know, 50% of the population that owns 85% of the guns, they're doing their best to lump them together into an enemy that they can't defeat. This enemy is very passive and misled and only wants to think the best. At a certain point, though, if you keep beating on people, they're going to start hitting back. The madness of this, the imprudence of this is truly shocking. And again, I keep coming back to this. It may be later than we think for the United States, because a regime that is this detached from reality doesn't have much future in it, I think.
Oh, I think they're completely attached to their own reality, just detached from the common person's reality.
Well, yeah, but they have to recognize that the common people can destroy their little worlds. And I think they're so arrogant that they don't recognize that. And that might be the end of end of their little games. So folks, we are basically running out of time. I want to just make a quick check through Entropy to see if anybody else has sent a question, comment, or donation in. I guess that does it there. And in terms of our friends with the Lemons, Diamonds, and Ninjaginis, let me see if we've got a few more of those. I don't want to leave anybody unthanked. Yeah, so we actually haven't had any of those. Oh, the Board Troll just donated one lemon. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. So what I would like to do is I'd like to wrap up by asking our two guests what they're working on next. So, Jim, you go first. What's coming up from you this
like I do every Saturday, I'm working on the worst week yet for Monday.
Is it the worst week yet?
Every week is the worst week. That's why I have the same title every week, because I don't see things getting better anytime soon. I mean, we've got last week I talked about the Black Miss Ireland. This week we've got the Black Miss England and Black Mr. England. And England's only 3.5% black. They're really pushing it. And African gangs in the Anglosphere, like England, Ireland, and Australia, and all these newspaper pieces denying that these are African gangs, even though they're phenotypically identified by the victims as appearing to be African. Maybe they're wearing those Tariq Nasheed rubber black guy masks. I'm not sure. What else we got here? Yeah, it's just the stuff, typical stuff for Monday. And, you know, they're just sticking it to the white people in the classrooms too. A lot of stuff about that. Well, otherwise, I mean, I'm in the long term, I'm getting that colorized Answer Me done sometime over the winter, hardcover, every page with full color. A lot of the original pictures like reproduced in full color. Nick Bugis has colorized all the original line art. So that'll be coming out, but that's a long-term project.
Even the Andrea Dworkin?
He colorized the Andrea Dworkin picture. Oh, yes, he did.
Oh, my God. Yeah. I don't know if I can stand seeing it in color. I still close my eyes and I can see it in black and white. That's forever burned into my memory. That's,
you can't unsee that one.
Andrea Dworkin's unshaved naked armpits. Yeah. Yep. Okay. So let's just switch to something else. I have to distract myself from this beatific vision. So Thomas, what are you working on for this coming week? I hope you're working on something.
I am. I'm actually doing some research for my next article. It's going to be what we do going forward, given mass election fraud. We had this election fraud come up in California. There's mass tyranny. So how do we deal with that? So I'm going to actually reread Ernest Younger's The Forest Passage, because he had a bunch of advice on how to deal with that back in his day with the Soviet Union, where he had these elections that were fraudulent, or it was like, you know, one-sided because no one wanted to be shot in the head. So I'm going to try to get some lessons from there and try to like put down some concrete, productive things we can do. I'm also going to do more research on Australia, because it looks like they have very useful trucker strikes over there. There's some type of like mass civil disobedience tactic.
Yeah, I'm very interested in the general strike. That used to be the thing of the left syndicalists. But then, you know, in the late 60s, early 70s, it was the construction worker hard hats who were beating up hippies in the streets of New York. And of course, you know, the left has never forgiven the working class for being right wing. And of course, they have earlier grievances than the hard hats, definitely. But that is really an interesting question. You know, the potential for working people and potential for a general strike of some sort to bring, or targeted strikes, not general strikes, to bring the system to a halt.
Yeah.
The big thing that I'm thinking about is the question of when do white Americans become ungovernable? That's sort of the direction that I think things are going in. America, there are vast parts of America that are not white that are ungovernable. When white people become ungovernable, then the system ends, I believe, because even though the system is attacking white people and stigmatizing white people and blaming white people for all of its problems and opening the borders to replace us, it also depends on white people in order to make it work. And that's its great weakness. It depends upon our cooperation in our own replacement. And once we no longer cooperate in that, things will change very, very rapidly. And it'll be slowly, right? But then it'll be all at once. And so there will be some sudden dramatic changes, I think, when that happens. And I'm looking forward to it. And I think it could be sooner than we all had thought. So anyway, guys, I want to thank you for joining us. Thomas, it's great, and we should definitely have you back. And Jim, it's always great. I want to thank the more than 200 people who are listening. And I appreciate people being good sports about changing the day. So thank you very much. I want to thank the donors especially. I want to thank our moderators. Gadius is out there. And I will be back next week, the same time, with another episode of Counter Currents Radio. So thank you.
Thanks, it's great.